clip story this evening comes from new writings in SF-12, edited by John Carnell and published by Bantam. This is Lee Harding's story, The Liberators. They tumbled blindly through the endless twilight of the tunnel, under the world, pallid little creatures with faces like polished pebbles, washed smooth by time, pursued by a growing sense of guilt. Mallow wondered if it was because they were leaving the city, and if their sudden exodus could be construed as a gross betrayal. But the poet had said, "Your responsibility is to yourselves, not to a machine, and least of all, to the city." And this much they believed, this much they had come to accept, that the city was no master, but a servile mechanism corrupted by a strange megalomania, and that their destinies had been founded ages ago upon individual human liberty, and not upon integration with a non-organic entity. But the ties of centuries were not easily broken, and that explained her uneasiness. It seemed likely now that the poet had, by the very stealth of his movements, offended the great city and aroused the antagonism she could sense in the dank air about them. The city did not wish them to go. There were five of them, a straggling line of limbless ovoids spun out like a necklace behind the poet, moving swiftly down the ancient passageways towards an unimaginable destination, far removed the false fabrications the city had thrust into their weak and willing minds. Ah, how strange, Mallow thought, how very, very strange life had become since the arrival of the poet. Existence had been a simple matter for Mallow, unencumbered by the need for decisions. Her function, as the city's biological memory, was supreme above all others. All that mankind had ever been lay buried in the rich darkness of her racial memory. And while the city nursed and nurtured her frail little body, her mind dwelt forever in a cycloramic past which somehow provided sustenance for the vast machine. For without Mallow's gift, there would have been no purpose. It would lie abandoned and lifeless like so many of its kind. Had it not been wise beyond the capabilities of those other desolated machines, it too might have sundered and collapsed under the burden of no purpose. But some savage quest kept it alive and functioning and growing. That was the most important facet of its existence. When others had crumbled into ruin, it had refined and extended its functions until it was possible for the inorganic mind of the city to extrapolate and perform feats far in advance of any machine previously conceived by man. Not all of the people had left. For some time, it had been aware of a few faint candles of organic life flickering pitifully in forgotten corners of the incredibly complex machine. They slept in their cells like pale, moist little moths, their minds made weak and flimsy by centuries of dwelling and drifting through the bright lands of their fashioning. For the dreamers were the dead, the ones who had traded a rich and full life for the tempting fantasies of their own subconscious. And the dreamers, the immortal slumberers, slept on through the ages. At first, the city probed warily about its discovery. Before it could actively engage the guttering minds of these creatures, it would have to create new techniques and new tools for the impossible task it had set itself. It did not take long. Seemingly unsurmountable problems fell one after the other beneath the battering ram of the city's remorseless logic. And when, for the first time, it entered the world of the dreamers, it was as a gently moving breeze that fails to disturb even the most frail of grasses. In many minds, it found only madness and corruption, cells deteriorated beyond any possible hope of repair. And there were others whose minds existed only as pale, grayish clouds in the awful stillness of their tombs. But there was eventual reward. From the moment the city first crept into the rich darkness of Mallow's thoughts, it knew that here was something beyond even its wildest imaginings. Here was a mind that was not only whole and undamaged by the centuries spent dreaming, but one capable of recalling the entire history of a race. The concept was staggering, and the implications equally endless. And it was from this vast tapestry the city forged a plan of development it would have once thought impossible. With the help of this and other minds it had found, it hoped to find some way of bridging the gap between organic life and its own. In the beginning, there was much confusion and much pain. A machine has no use for emotions. A machine has no soul, and a machine cannot dream. Yet it coveted these things that it found in the mind of Malo. The race had deserted it without bestowing the ultimate gift of life upon their creation. Now it would finish a clumsy effort by uniting itself with flesh and mind and soul. Before the awakening, it spun a subtle and cruel web to ensnare the captive minds. One by one it roused them and fastened their thoughts to its snare so that, although they had left their own dreams behind, they now shared a new one created for them by the city. They had never been alive. It had merely traded them one dream for another. Only in this case it was a dream with a purpose, the city's. And so it crept into their minds and enslaved them and sucked at the rich juice of their thoughts and became a parasite. Malo never knew the meaning of loneliness. She had many companions in mind. There was Bael, who bred for the city, and Antar, who slept, ate, and excreted in the manner of his ancestors and to the satisfaction of the city. And there were others whose functions were not quite important. Through Anita, the eager machine could enjoy the delight of the human bloodstream, and by entering the feeble mind of Primo, could explore the fascinating world of insanity, the concept of not sane being of particular interest to the city. And by integrating these helpless little human relics into its cybernetic heart, it imagined itself something better than the machines which had preceded it, something that was not a complex structure of metals and electricity, and something not quite human either. It was simply the city, only different. Malo had been dreaming when the poet arrived. Bewildered, she sought explanation from the city and watched with alarm a milky translucence begin to spread throughout her mind, swallowing the dark wonder of her thoughts and leaving her head full of no thoughts. And then she felt something grotesque move into her mind. Something with the form and sense of a man, and yet not quite so. A giant, large and gross of feature, like something from the primeval past. She moved suddenly away from the intruder and studied him curiously. He stretched out a hand, and with his fingertips gently pierced her silver shell of comfort, and the giant caught her in his arms and smiled down upon her.
Come with me, little one, and I will teach you to walk.
The first words to sunder the dreadful darkness that had overtaken her. It was like waking from a long and unpleasant dream to find the truth waiting patiently to be grasped by her unsteady mind. She had thought that within her mind rested all that mankind had ever been, because the city had told her so. But now she saw how the city had bled her memories and fed back only those which it thought necessary for its purposes, and that the accumulated information of millennia had become outdated in this one blinding instant of real awareness. She felt as if she was being made over again, her tiny body tingling with unfamiliar sensations and her eager mind buzzing with extraordinary impatience. Then the images faded and the darkness returned. Finally, Malo opened her eyes. Focus came gradually, and then she saw the grotesque shape looming over her. She beheld the poet outside her world.
I have come to take you away from here, away from the city, to where you and your people were meant to live. I'm taking you home, Malo. Have patience, little one. One cannot undo the work of eons in the space of a moment. There is no need to force yourself. Words are the great gift of man. But there are times when they may be dispensed with to advantage. So,
relax and listen to what I have to say. The rest will come in good time. To facilitate her comprehension still farther, there remained one final adjustment, and while her brain fumbled to absorb the concept involved, the process of interpenetration was begun and completed. Mallow felt a soft, warm splinter of the poet slide smoothly into her mind, and when this was done, she hung frail and helpless on the gigantic loom of the giant psyche. The brightness and the sense of power was breathtaking, and now there was no longer any difficulty in communication. I will show you freedom. A vast plain filled her being, stretched as far away as her eyes could see. Sunlight scorched the green land, and a soft, hazy line of mountains lined the far horizon. Before her, in the very foreground of her vision, a small group of the golden giants, and among them, a smaller and hauntingly familiar figure. He smiled and waved to her an affectionate greeting.
Hello, Mallow. Remember me?
Remember him? Of course. Didn't she have the finest memory in all the city? It was Pilar, and although she could see how the rudimentary arms and legs had grown and strengthened, and the familiar features of ancient man had begun to transform the once smooth flesh of his face, Mallow knew without question that this was indeed her friend, so long since they had dreamed together across space and time.
I sent them back, Mallow, to save you and the others. They know how to, and you must trust them, believe in them, especially the poet. He will guide you outside where we were meant to live. Help him to find the others, Mallow. Do not be afraid. There is so much they can do for us. So much.
The great empty spaces of Earth spun dizzily about her, and Mallow was once more alone in the resting place of the poet's mind. She shivered then and huddled down against the warmth of his arms. At that moment she sensed the gloomy walls of her cell begin to move restlessly. Her eyes flew open and stared at the poet wonderingly. An unpleasant disturbance seemed to have traveled through the great organs of the city, and Mallow said, "It knows you are here."
"Not exactly. It has detected a wrongness, but that is only to be expected. It has lost one of its people, Mallow. It will be upset and will probably try to find you. But that will take some time. By then, we shall all be well clear of the city. We are random factors beyond the ability of this machine to predict. And besides, it is very slow. And now, we must seek out your friends."
Mallow felt her breath momentarily leave her in a sudden rush. A blur of swift movement swallowed her world, and then she was being borne out of her cell and through the depths of the city, with her time sense radically altered to correspond to her new environment. Once there had been streets, but that had been ages ago, when human beings maintained the use of their lower limbs for locomotion, and had also traversed the city in their many ingenious little machines. But the highways had been gradually swallowed by the encroaching structures which made up the metropolis, and the bald sky had been dutifully robbed of its delicate tracery of freeways and passovers. Gradually, the ages accumulated, and there was no longer a need for costly and cumbersome and archaic means of transport. The city coalesced and became a vast honeycomb of tunnels and tubes and passageways where the inhabitants could move more conveniently between various points. It was down one of those great tunnels they now sped. They entered Antar's chamber first and penetrated that gloomy womb until they found him grimly hammocked by the city, floating pale and weak inside his translucent sphere. The poet plucked him free like a lifeless fruit, and after a moment, it was a small eternity in her companion's mind while he learned all that she had learned of the truth, released his pale body so that it drifted lightly beside her own. They spent an idle moment studying each other, sharing this new and terrifying experience, before the poet moved out of the chamber. They felt a gentle tug, as from an unseen thread, and they were whisked off after him and trailed his flying body at a respectable distance as they fled farther into the complex maze of the city's interior. Almost as they departed, an uneasy susurrus trembled the empty silence of the chamber. Bael's cell was much larger than theirs had been, so huge that the walls faced away into murky gloom. In the very center of the unpleasant room was a great vat, and behind the transparent plastic something vaguely human gleamed on. The poet left them by the doorway, and he alone approached the strange vat. He could see that something clearly moved within, something huge and monstrous that might have once been human, undulated, unaware. How many, many tons of flesh held the guttering spark of consciousness he could only just detect? And for how long had this creature suffered such abuse? Only then did the monstrous design of the city become clear to Mallow. She thought of Bael as the city had pictured her, and then stared again at the sickening sight in the vat. There could be no greater treachery than this.
She feels no pain, Mallow. We must see what we can do for her.
Only then did they sense his defeat. The task was hopeless from the very beginning. As each successive layer of flesh was probed to find the faint spark of intelligence he knew was there, there came only an increasing desperation. For there were some things still beyond the power to heal. Bael had been conditioned as a breeding mechanism, and the city had seen that sufficient consciousness remained to keep them out in the flesh alive, but nothing beyond that. This was a mind beyond salvation. Nothing more than the most primitive accumulation of nerves and muscles necessary. A billion candle power brain reduced to the merest flicker. There was nothing that could be done. So he withdrew and wondered in what dark chamber rested the monstrous miscarriages of this dark union. Had the city sought to perpetuate the race, or something more sinister than that? Reluctantly, he stepped back and seemed to wait, hesitantly for a moment. There was a mutter in the air between them, and a golden shimmer as a shadow moved towards the poet. Only then did Mallow realize that their giant was not alone in the city. The air vibrated eerily with their communication. The golden shimmer moved towards the vat, and the walls of the chamber bulged and screamed like a beast. The poet and the shadow froze. The poet spun around, and what happened next was much too swift for Mallow to follow. But when the breathlessness had passed, they were elsewhere, and burrowing down, down, down into the bowels of the city in search of more of her companions. And all in that blurred instant of time, the golden shimmer remained behind in the chamber and moved over and into the terrible vat and did that which was necessary. Then it also fled to another part of the city to continue the urgent work. The dim light of consciousness sputtered and winked out within the great mountain flesh. Death had returned to the city. Within the vast metropolis, there was movement where once there had been only unbroken stasis. There was activity where before there had been only a pervading emptiness, and flickering shadows flitting furtively through the multicellular structure of the city. As a machine, it had only an indirect knowledge of the nature of pain. And deprived of emotions, there was no way of registering grief. But a loss could be felt. A certain indignation could be generated when it sensed a violation of its being. Any direct damage to any one of its parts, however small, could provoke an anger comparable to that most terrible of human emotions. At first, there was only a sudden shock at the abrupt removal of one of its vital organic components. Now, only a raw and ragged emptiness where once had glowed the bright and brilliant mind of the one called Mallow. For too long had the city dreamed. Its movements were sluggish, reactions incredibly slothful. As it fought to shrug off the blanket of lethargy from its feeble mind, it could feel the bright segments of its newly found consciousness slowly winking out one after another, so that gradually it was returning to its original state, a machine of metal and plastic, shot through the pseudo-life of electricity and fusion power, and becoming less and less of the grand and noble creature it had envisioned, a cybernetic mind bound irrevocably to the tissue of human energy. The dream was ending. A fierce rage welled up within the city, and the struggle began. Already the magnificent intelligence was fading. Deprived of Malo's biological memory, it was forced to fall back upon old and disused circuits in its own mind, so that it might devise a means of expelling the creatures from its system. Gradually, as it felt the passage of the tiny creatures through its substance, the mind grew progressively dimmer. Already the pleasures of flesh and organic mind had faded, and the remorseless crush of steel was returning to the city. The invaders were men. The weary mind wrestled with this impossible equation. There were no men, not anymore. Only those, it held those who dreamed. Ah, but the lights were fading, fading, fading. The vast bulk of the city lay above them now. At dizzying speed, the poet whisked his slender cargo along through the very bottommost levels of the city's tunnel system. They had not anticipated the almost human agony of the city. Even now, its despair flew after them, leapt from every fresh turn in the twisting passageways. And the city cried,
"You do not understand! I am like you! Like you!"
Then the voice had faded away and died, so that only this dreadful susurrus traveled through the walls, following them as they probed deeper and darker and closer to the world, until the last spark of humanity guttered and died within the dark mind of the machine, and only an aching and intolerable hatred remained. The walls of the tunnel lurched and crushed in upon them. For Malo and her companions, there was not even time for terror. They realized that the city had sought to destroy them. It would rather have killed them than have lost. But now they were outside. The world burst open with incredible splendor. The great blue sky held a promise of boundless infinity. Already she could sense a tingling excitement through the stubs of her rudimentary limbs. They sped over a rich carpet of green, and the mad cry of the city became only a faint annoyance in the background of color that invaded her senses. It was even more beautiful than the poet had promised. His blazing aura was gone, she saw, and he now found time to turn around and smile reassuringly. By carefully understating the real world, the poet had left the wonder for herself to unravel. They swung up a gentle slope of a small knoll where another group of giants stood waiting. With a gentle puff, they were dropped to the ground and the sweet smell of grass captured the air. She looked back the way they had come. There were other convoys of giants and their charges making towards the hill. And it was incredible how much the city had kept from her. Why, there must have been many, many more people imprisoned than she had thought. But all that was over. It was strange to see the city from the outside. It lay huddled against the land like a monstrous scab, several miles high and groping out greedily towards the near horizons, a vast wedge of tumbling matter. Once there had been fine spires scraping at the sky, but no more. The passage of time had forced a terrible pattern upon the once noble machine, and in its dazed and crippled mind, there was now only darkness, darkness everywhere, and of hope, no sign at all. Raging impotence whirling like an acrid fluid throughout its vast and lonely structure. The poet said,
"Come, little ones, we must go."
Now she saw the great golden sphere shimmering impatiently atop the hill. They were raised in that warm and gentle way they were accustomed to, and as they were whisked towards an open portal, there came a terrifying sound which tore savagely at the world. Malo cried out, but the poet said reassuringly,
"It is nothing.
nothing to fear. And this was so. But the sound, it was the anguished cry of the city that leapt after them. It seemed it would last for all eternity as a mark of their passing. The ground beneath the wild machine began to shake, and the grass around the sphere writhed like an animal in pain. Silently, they turned and watched the agony of the city. It rose very slowly into the sky and hovered, uncertain senses wildly gyrating. Only one thought was dominant. It had slumbered too long at the benevolent breast of the earth. It had dreamed a dream, and now that dream had ended. There would always be existence, but now it would once more be without purpose. For several long moments it seemed undecided. Then, a terrible cry still clawing at the sunlight, it surged many hundreds of feet into the air and wheeled blindly around and careened away towards the far horizon. Long after it had faded to a dim smudge against the blue of the sky, its doleful cry lingered like a scar upon the day. But that was not for Malo's thoughts. The great ship lifted and flung them at the stars where they might scatter like jewels once they had been made over as men again, and would have a universe for their playground. Already she had sloughed off the useless carapace of her old and senseless life, and could feel her mind, like her growing limbs, bursting with fresh growth, rich and strange, while far below and beyond the range of discarded care, the city fled blindly over a dark and lonely ocean in search of tomorrow, crooning its mournful loss like some stricken animal. Wallowing on until the dreadful arms of night swept down and everything was dark and only the uncaring stars looked down and the earth turned again and again and again and was unchanging and forsaken and forever young. This is Michael Hansen, technical operation for this program by Rich Grody.